possibility of communication is something that tails off gradually. It starts very well, and then, you know, there's a kind of a drop-off, and you can't say where it stops. And when I go to England and walk around London and listen to people talking Cockney, that's English, but I can't understand a word they're saying. At that point, communication is broken, and there's a kind of a whole range in between. But insofar as there's an account of communication, it presumably works something like this. So let's take, say, John and Mary. John's trying to understand Mary. What does John do? Well, probably what John does is make a guess, subconsciously, of course. Assume that Mary is like me. If I'm talking to Mary, you know. I assume Mary is like me, you know. Modulo some set of modifications, you know, like Mary's like me, and I'll have to make some modifications if it doesn't work out. So first I assume Mary's like me. Then when I listen to her, turns out not exactly. I've got to introduce some modifications to get her to be like me. Most of this just happens automatically. It's probably peripheral to the nervous system. You tune in to other people in pronunciation and probably in everything else. And you try to find a way of interpreting what they say as what you would have said. And if you can make that interpretation, you understand what they said, namely what you would have said. Well, sometimes that process is easy, sometimes it's hard, sometimes it's hopeless. You know, it just varies all over the place. But there's nothing non-internalist about it. It's always internalist, and you can use any method you like. You know, most of it's probably subconscious and reflexive, but if you want to try methods, like, you know, look things up in a book or write them down or whatever you may try, you can use those methods. No rules about it. Insofar as I succeed in the task of introducing these modifications, I understand what Mary says. To the extent that I don't succeed or I made the wrong moves, I misunderstand what she says, which is often true among people. The point is that positing shared entities has no more explanatory value than positing shared shapes. We don't need any such weird notion to explain communication insofar as we can explain it at all. Well, some of these points are made in the literature, but again, and sometimes in a queer way. There's an important paper by Donald Davidson in which he comments on these things. He constructs what he calls an interpreter. He says the basic topic to be looked at is the interpreter. What's the interpreter? The interpreter is a model of a person in a communication situation. This is, say, John. And the interpreter is getting expressions coming in, say, talking to Mary. So here's Mary out here, and here's John. And the interpreter is trying to figure out what Mary said. So it's trying to give some, you know, some expression or whatever, maybe the language of thought or whatever you think this happens in, accounts for what Mary says. And Davidson points out quite accurately that you can use any method at all. You know, in fact, he says, again, correctly, that interpreting is like finding your way around in the world. You know, it's anything. Anything goes for interpretation. That part is quite correct. He then goes on to draw a very odd conclusion, which I'll read. He concludes that there is no use for the concept of language at all. There's no use for the concept of language serving as a portable interpreting machine. You know, thing that you got in your head, you carry around. Set to grind out the meaning of an arbitrary utterance. There's no purpose in any notion of generative procedure or high language or whatever. We are led to abandon not only the ordinary notion of a language, but we have erased the boundary between knowing a language and knowing our way around the world generally. And he means this conclusion to apply both to linguists who've talked about language as a portable interpreting machine, if you like, and to philosophers. Everybody who has talked about languages is wrong deeply because there are no such things. There's no languages, there's no procedures for, you know, there's no computational procedure for associating form and meaning. It's all a mistake. And the reason is because when we meet somebody, we construct what he calls a passing theory, a tentative theory. John constructs a passing theory about Mary. A tentative theory judge based on what he's picked up about Mary using any device that he can, and that's all there is. There's a passing theory, and once you've said goodbye to Mary, you throw it out and you wait till the next communication situation. Since there are no rules, I'm quoting now again, since there are no, we have erased the boundary, I forget whether I quoted this or not, we have erased the boundary between knowing a language and knowing our way around the world generally, so there's no more any notion of knowledge of language or language. Since there are no rules for arriving at passing theories, anything goes, we must give up the idea of a clearly defined shared structure which language users acquire and then apply to cases. There's no such thing as a language, period. That's, in fact, the opening sentence of a recent book on Davidson's work, which Davidson endorses as, you know, the best exposition of what he had in mind. Opens by saying there is no such thing as a language, and then shows how Davidson got to this point over the years. You know, first he said there's no such thing as a sentence, and on. He finally got to the ultimate point, there's no such thing as a language. And the reason is there are no rules for finding passing theories. Actually, notice that there's something right in those conclusions. There is no, we have to give up the idea of a clearly defined shared structure. Now that I agree with. There never was any such notion as a shared structure. He puts that in the same category with everything else because of the common assumption, the near universal assumption, that it's been shown that you can't account for communication or anything else unless you have shared structure, common public language. As I mentioned, that's sort of universal. So he therefore, it's a big point for him to throw out that along with the idea of a language altogether, and that we should indeed throw out and have never invoked. But let's look at the other part. We have to give up the concept of a generative grammar, you know, a recursive a generative procedure that characterizes the form and meaning of utterances. We have to give up the notion of a language as something that's a state of the brain or anything else. There is no such thing as language. There is no such thing as knowing a language. These are just parts of finding your way around the world, period. No further distinctions. Well, the initial statement is correct. You can use anything you do to form a passing theory. But if you're reasonable, you know, you're going, I mean, that's like, you know, it's like saying you take a motion picture of the world, everything is happening. Okay. If everything is happening when you take a motion picture of the world, does it follow that you should give up any effort to do chemistry, let's say? I mean, because that's not everything that's happening in the world. Well, obviously not. I mean, if you want to make, it's perfectly true that you're never going to understand this. I mean, to understand interpretation, what people do when they try to adapt to other human beings, that's so far beyond the possibility of inquiry that nobody serious even thinks about it. That's the kind of thing you write novels about. You don't carry out scientific inquiry about it. It's just too huge a topic. I mean, in the natural sciences, there's no such topic as studying everything. You know, you can't do that. There's no such question in the sciences as why do things happen, let's say, or why are things the way they are. You know, I mean, those are questions, but they're not questions in the sciences because they just involve everything, you know. And if you want to study something, any topic, what you try to do is find some, you know, you try to find some part of the general mess of things which has the remarkable feature that if you look at that one, you'll get to some of the basic principles, and ultimately maybe you'll slowly build up to getting some sense of the junk that's going on in the world. Well, that's obvious. And to refuse that in this case is another form of really quite pernicious non-naturalism. Maybe, I'm sure Davidson will talk about that when he comes here next time, because it's a leading position in his current view of the world. You know, he thinks that's in fact probably his major philosophical contribution. But it seems to me it just follows from a dramatic form of non-naturalism. Well, go on. This is a class of arguments to try to show that either language doesn't exist at all or that it's not in your head if it does exist. And there are other languages, there are other arguments of that type, and they take us into the last topic that I want to get into, and that's the topic of meaning and reference. Okay? The core of semantics. And, you know, big topics. In the last 20 years, there's been actually quite intriguing work done on what are called externalist theories of meaning and reference. This starts with papers by, more or less simultaneous papers by Putnam and Kripke, two quite important contemporary philosophers, about the late 60s or the early 70s. You know, it starts with talks, and then they wrote them up. And they're kind of similar. Then there's further work by people like Tyler Burge, who I think I mentioned before, and, you know, by now, thousands of people. Externalist theories of reference and meaning. These aim to show that meaning isn't in the head, as Putnam put it. Contrary to traditional beliefs that meanings were like concepts or something or other in the head, these efforts try to show that meanings are not in the head. Meanings are in the facts about the world and in the social interactions among people. That's where meanings reside. Now, since meanings are, since Frege, what determines the fixation of reference, okay, the meaning of a word is the method for fixing its reference, it's going to follow that reference is not in the head, not only in the sense that the things you're referring to aren't in the head, which of course everybody agrees to, like the table isn't in my head, you know, everybody agrees to that, if I say table, but the mode of fixing reference that I use when I call this a table isn't in my head either. It's in the world. It's either in physical reality, which I may not know at all, or in the social world of which I have only a partial and erroneous grasp. Notice it's going to follow that if these arguments go through, that, see, well now, this fits very well with the idea about livid and disinterested, that I may not know the meanings of my words, right? In fact, it'll turn out that commonly you don't know the meanings of your words. You'll only know the meanings of the words you use if you know the ultimate answers that physics is someday going to give about reality, and if you know everything about the relevant norms and conventions of your community, which is very unlikely. Only then will you know the meanings of the words you use. Short of that, you only have a partial and erroneous grasp. That's the same conclusion, but it's going to come from quite a different course. These externalist theories, which are almost universal, I mean, those of you who know the philosophical literature will know they're not even debated anymore, they define a notion which is called broad content, or sometimes wide content, which is the externalist notion of meaning. Okay, the notion of meaning that's determined by the truth about the world and by the social world in which you live. That's broad content or wide content. So the meaning of the word water, let's say, is determined by reality, right? Like if scientists find out that there's a variety of water called deuterium oxide, then that's what you were talking about all along, although you didn't know it, because that's part of reality. You know, it's another chemical variety of water with different isotopes and stuff. And if they find some other thing tomorrow, you know, that water really isn't H2O at all, it's some other thing, then that's what you were talking about all along. Furthermore, if people in what's called your community, especially experts, have information about the world that you don't have, then the real meaning of the words you use is determined by their practice, not yours. So it's going to turn out that aside from accident, you rarely know the meaning of your words, and you rarely know what you're referring to. Okay? That's going to follow. I'll go through some of the examples before in a moment. But that's the general picture. That's the externalist theory of meaning, which is, you know, overwhelmingly adopted at the moment. Well, let's start with some of the social factors in meaning. These divide into two types: social factors in meaning, and real world factors in meaning. Okay, that's the two types of things that determine meaning and reference. All externalist, all outside the mind. Oh yeah, I mentioned wide content and broad content. This kind of meaning. There's a big debate in the literature about whether, in addition to wide content and broad content, there's also narrow content. That's the other concept. Now, narrow content is the traditional notion of meaning, in which the meaning of a word is in your head. Okay. That's narrow content. There's no longer any debate about wide content. That's accepted as demonstrated. That's there, you know. But there is a debate in whether, in addition to it, there's also a notion of meaning which is just inside your head, a kind of an I language version of meaning, as is the traditional view, in fact, that meaning's in your head. So like when Putnam came out with this 25 or so years ago with the article saying meaning isn't in your head, that was considered really shocking. It had always been assumed that it was, but the argument seemed to show that it isn't. So the question is there also a notion of narrow content, kind of like the traditional one, an I language notion of content just means meaning, you know. Is there a narrow notion of meaning? But there isn't any debate about broad content. So like Jerry Fodor gives arguments saying, well, there's narrow content too, but nobody argues virtually about the non-existence of broad content. The externalist views have swept the field in the past 20 years. We're now into sort of the technical literature on the theory of reference and the theory of meaning. Okay. There are arguments, and what one has to see is whether the arguments have a natural internalist explanation. Okay. Notice that this is going to be wildly non-natural. Okay, because there are going to be things like real meanings that are, you know, that are just unidentifiable in people's knowledge or behavior and so on, somewhere else, you know, Platonistic or whatever. Again, it's striking that there are no comparable arguments given about pronunciation. Though if you run through the arguments in the literature, you'll find that you can give comparable arguments about pronunciation pretty much all the way through. Well, let's have a look at, start with some of the social factors in meaning, the alleged social factors. So a standard kind of paradigm of discussion that goes back to Tyler Burge has to do with somebody who he calls Bert. So Bert is all over the literature now. And Bert goes to the doctor and complains that he has arthritis. Okay, arthritis is a disease of the joints. Bert goes to the doctor, and not being very educated, Bert tells the doctor that there are many variants of this argument, you know, 1,000 different variants. I'll just pick one. Bert goes to the doctor and says, look, I've got arthritis in my ankle and in my thigh. Here, you know. So I got arthritis. Bert goes to the doctor, I'm suffering from arthritis. The doctor says, where? He says, in my ankle and my thigh. Well, okay, the doctor looks at Bert's ankle and finds out he just sprained his ankle. There's no arthritis there. So he's just wrong about that. But with regard to his thigh, he isn't just wrong. He misused the word. Arthritis isn't the kind of thing that you can have in your thigh. Okay, so he misused the word. And therefore, there was a real meaning of the word, arthritis, and that meaning is in the social community, and Bert just didn't know it. Okay. And what will happen in this case? Well, you know, Bert will either change his meaning because he defers to the expertise of the doctor, or he'll say, I'll keep doing it this way because that's what I like, you know, it's his choice. Well, does this demonstrate the existence of wide content? That is a meaning of arthritis that's outside of Bert's head, in this case in the social world. Well, there's a perfectly simple externalist paraphrase of all of this, internalist paraphrase of all of this. Bert has a certain I language. Okay, in his I language, arthritis is a pain in various places in your body. That's the meaning of the word arthritis for Bert, and it includes the thigh and the ankle. He goes to the doctor, and the doctor tells him, look, we professionals use the term differently. And Bert may decide to pick up that new usage or not, that's all. There's nothing substantive missing from that account. That's a completely internalist account. As far as I can see, nothing substantive is missing from it. Well, that's the debate. That's the debate. Was Bert wrong in the first case? See, Burge's intuition, Tyler Burge's intuition, and the thing that's supposed to give the argument, is that Bert was wrong, but wrong in different ways. Okay. In both cases, Bert was wrong, but wrong in different ways. In the case of his ankle, he was wrong because he had a sprained ankle, not arthritis. In the case of his thigh, he was wrong in a deeper sense. He was misusing the language. Okay. He was misusing words when he said that he had arthritis in his thigh. So wrong isn't quite the word for it. He wasn't saying anything. You know? In the case of arthritis in his thigh, he wasn't saying anything. So, but it's not a matter of being wrong, actually. Well, those are the intuitions. And underlying it is the notion of misuse of language, which is extremely common. Now, have a look. So let's bring it up. What do we mean by misuse of language? Well, there is an I language version of misuse of language. Namely, I got some I language in my head, and I may well speak in a way which is inconsistent with it, either because the sentence got so complicated I got lost, or I'm confused by some other factor, or I had too much to drink this afternoon, or whatever. You know, I mean, that's misuse of language in an I language sense. Okay. I mean, after all, your language faculty is only one component of what enters into what you do. You know, what you do is not a reflection of your language faculty. It's the result of the interaction of the language faculty and a thousand other things. Okay. So it's very possible that what you produce or the way you interpret something will not be in accord with your actual rules. Okay. That's highly possible, and there are many ordinary cases of that. All right, that's one notion of misuse of language. That's a notion of misuse of language that carries over to naturalistic inquiry, to the sciences. Is there any other notion of misuse of language? Not as far as I can see. Every other notion of misuse of language always involves reference to common public language or, you know, fact about the world or something. And if those notions, like, it makes reference to broad content. Now, it's true that we talk about misuse of language all the time, but we also talk about having beliefs about health. Right? We shouldn't get confused, but I mean, it's perfectly okay to keep talking exactly the way they do. We do, just not to be misled about it. Wittgenstein's point again. There's nothing wrong with ordinary discourse. Fine, the way it is. But don't be misled about it by thinking it has properties it doesn't have. Like thinking that because people look alike, there's a common form. Or because they talk alike, there's a common language. And all the other notions of misuse of language really mean you're not using language the way some authority structure says you should, or something like that. In the case when you ask, was Bert wrong about his ankle, we have a simple answer. Was Bert wrong about his thigh? Well, if you mean by that Bert was not using the language the way the doctor did, and the doctor's the authority figure, that's correct. Now, if that's what you mean by misuse of language, fine, but that's completely internalist notion. Because the doctor has a state of the brain, Bert has a state of the brain, and in this social situation, the doctor's is privileged. Okay. You want the doctor to fix you, you better let him do it his way. Okay. But there's nothing there about, there's nothing externalist in that. Okay. That's typical of a big class of cases. I won't give other examples. But that's a typical example of a huge class of cases of alleged social factors and meaning. Sometimes it's also argued that this goes beyond language, it goes to concept formation. So Burge, for example, argues that to say that a person has mastered a concept, say Bert, to say that Bert has or has not mastered the concept arthritis requires that we refer to a common language in which the concept is expressed with its actual meaning. So we'll say of Bert over here that he hasn't yet mastered the concept of arthritis because there's a real concept, you know, namely disease of the joints, and Bert had a different concept, which he called arthritis. Okay. So he hadn't mastered the concept. Again, notice that there's analogs in the case of pronunciation. Suppose Bert pronounces it arthritis. Suppose Bert, you know, he never heard it said or something, he saw it written. So he goes to the doctor and he says, I got arthritis in my ankle. Well, is he misusing the language? Is there a real pronunciation which he doesn't have in the common language? Well, you could say so if you want, but it would be extremely confusing. What you ought to say is Bert has a different phonological representation associated with some set of concepts. He has a certain set of, he has a certain pairing of phonological representations and semantic values, and it's not the same as that of the doctor's. In my case, it's not the same either in the phonology or in the semantics. How do we know that that's the concept close to the doctor's concept? Well, just because when we try to understand their interaction, we see that they map each other that way. When they're trying to communicate, each of them figures, I got to reinterpret this other guy. You know, that's the interpretation procedure. I've got to interpret him as saying what I'm doing. I'm going to do it in the minimal way. And these are the points in their respective eye languages that are closest together in terms of phonetic and semantic features. Notice that that procedure may fail. You may pick out something that isn't really close at all. Well, in that case, you misunderstood the other person, which is certainly something that happens all the time. Nothing strange about that. But again, there's a completely internalist account. Suppose that you meet Bert, you know, not the doctor, I meet Bert, and he complains about his arthritis. Well, my initial posit, my first guess, is he's identical to me. So, and I think it's, you know, a disease of the joints, so probably he thinks so. If I get some evidence that he didn't, like he starts complaining about his thigh, well, okay, I'll make some modifications in my interpretation procedure for him. And there's no limit to the range in which this takes place, and there are no rules for it, exactly as Davidson says. That's a matter of constructing a passing theory, and you do it any way you can. That seems to be an accurate description of communication. You know, it doesn't seem to be anything missing from this description of communication. It seems accurate. It's not very interesting, because it says you do anything you can in order to try to reduce misunderstanding, but that just seems to be a fact. There doesn't seem to be an interesting theory of communication other than try to work things out in such a way that the other person will be saying what you would have said. That seems to be what communication is about. It's not interesting, too bad. Suppose we say, here's another case. Suppose that we say that Peter's trying to improve his Italian. Okay, we can say that. He's misusing Italian now, but he's trying to improve his Italian. Well, what does that mean? What it means is, on internalist grounds, that he's trying to get his eye language Italian, which is, you know, his eye language, which isn't really Italian, it's just something in his head. He's trying to modify it so it gets closer and closer to a certain range of people of no determinate boundaries. It could be all kinds of people. He's trying to get it closer to a whole bunch of people, and he's introducing modifications insofar as he can to get closer to those people in his eye language. Okay, that's all it means to say somebody's trying to improve his Italian. We don't seem to add anything to this account if we say there is an entity, Italian, which is the common language that he's misusing. I'll stop with the last case, which is the famous one. Hilary Putnam's what he calls division of linguistic labor, which is the first example that was given of social factors and meaning. The idea is this. Putnam says that there's a kind of a tree called an elm tree, and there's another kind of tree called a beech tree. And having grown up in the city, like most of us, he doesn't have, all he knows is they're both big trees, you know, big trees with leaves. But presumably he's using these words with some meaning, okay? He even knows that they're different in meaning. Okay, but that's all he knows in his head is big tree. Okay, like if you look up a biblical dictionary where people are trying to make up the meanings of words for texts in the Bible, you'll often find things like kind of tree, you know, or kind of animal. They couldn't figure out any more than that. Well, that's all that Hilary Putnam knows about elm trees and beech trees. But there's a meaning to the words. Well, what's the meaning to the words? Well, the meaning must be given by experts. There's somebody around who knows the difference. So the real meaning of elm tree and beech tree is what the experts mean by it. That's called the division of linguistic labor. And maybe you'll defer to the experts. Like you really want to, you know, you want to buy a beech tree to plant it because somebody said it would look nice in 50 years. You'll defer to the expert and ask him which is the beech tree and which is the elm tree. And that's the true meaning. You don't have it. It's not in your head. No, what about that? Let's say that it's me, okay? I don't know the difference between an elm tree and a beech tree. Let's say there's an Italian gardener who works in my neighborhood. Only speaks Italian. Doesn't speak a word of English. I don't speak a word of Italian. We share something. We share the Latin names, you know. We both know the Latin names for these things. So I give him the Latin name, and he says, oh, that's this. You know, and say, okay, now I know what a beech tree is. So does this mean that the Italian speaker with whom I don't share a word is part of my linguistic community? I mean, is Italian part of English? You know? Well, that's a perfectly good case of division of linguistic labor. I suppose I want to know the meaning of, you know, angular momentum or something. And the only guy around is a German-speaking physicist. So I, you know, write it out, and he knows that much English, and he gives some explanation, which I look up the words in a dictionary. Okay, I've now got the meaning of this technical term, and I've gotten it from an expert who doesn't speak English at all. I mean, or maybe minimally, you know. So it must be that we're part of a shared community. In fact, if you pursue this line of reasoning, everybody's part of the same community. There's only one shared language, because you could do this in any possible way. And you don't need any of it. It's only a question of how people with particular eye languages choose to accept certain deference patterns, which is a question of authority and interrelations. It has nothing to do with language. Like, I might decide to accept what the Italian gardener tells me, or I might not. In my eye language, like Putnam's, Elm and Beech have different entries, but they both have the same semantic features. There may be a general principle about the lexicon that says if two words aren't identified as having the same semantic features, they have different meanings. And these two aren't identified as having the same semantic features. They just happen to not differ in semantic features. So that's presumably the basis for our knowledge that whatever they are, they're different. But that's just a general property of lexical structure. Beyond that, there's nothing to say. I mean, I can go to an expert and modify my eye language if I like. This peripheral part of eye language, the, you know, lexical names for what are called natural kinds, though they really aren't, that's the kind that you can modify through life at will, and sure, we can do that. Very peripheral to the language, and there's nothing more to be said about it. Again, it's like all these other questions. We can answer everything from an internalist point of view in an uninteresting way, but the questions are uninteresting. The questions are uninteresting because there's every possible form of deference relation, authority relation, social interaction, and so on. And there's not going to be anything to say about those topics in general, except do the best you can, you know, and make changes where you feel it helps your life out or something like that. There's nothing more general to say. Well, final comment. For perfectly familiar reasons, there's nothing in this that suggests any problem with ordinary usage. Right, just that we not make mistakes about it. Actually, remember, there was a reason that Putnam had, which I talked about earlier, so I won't talk about it now. He argues that this externalist view is necessary to make sense of the intelligibility of science. We want to explain that Niels Bohr wasn't talking nonsense when he was using the pre-quantum theoretic account of electron, but that doesn't seem necessary either for the reasons I discussed before.
Okay.
Item by item. Does it make sense to make phonetic semantic correlations item by item? Okay, so let's take you and me. Is that the question?
Yeah.
Okay, let's take you and me. I mean, we speak a slightly different variety of English, okay, natively in both cases, so, you know, no question about second language. Is there a fixed mapping that correctly associates my lexical entries with your lexical entries?
For one individual.
Yeah, does it make sense? I see. Does it make sense to say that for me, say, the word fall is a certain set of phonetic and semantic and other, you know, what's often called values, features of some kind, and probably other junk, like it's a verb, say. Does it make sense to say that? Why not?
And every other word.
And every other word. Yeah. Every word is some collection of the... Every linguistic... It makes sense... Maybe it's wrong, but it makes sense to say that an eye language is a generative procedure, the extension of which is the class of sets like that, where the elements of those sets are universal, notice. The elements of those sets are taken from universal phonetics and universal semantics, so they are common. But they're just our nature, you know. Our nature is to have certain ways of articulating and certain ways of interpreting. And we set up collections of those things. Yeah, we could if we like. The reason why I don't like to do it is that there are several reasons. For one thing, the term grammar is hopelessly confusing. I mean, the traditional term grammar means a thing you go to the library. Yeah, his question is, which is perfectly sensible, we have the notion I language, and the I language generates a certain set of things, okay? Expressions. Each expression is a collection of features, and his proposal is the following. Instead of calling this the language, let's call it the grammar. And let's call this extension the language. Okay? So the language is an infinite class of expressions under this terminology. And the generative procedure is a grammar under this terminology. It's terminology, so we really don't care much what we decide. But my own view is it's probably not a good terminological choice, which is why I didn't use it, for several reasons. One reason is that the term grammar has a kind of systematic ambiguity to it, which has been confusing the hell out of everybody for 30 years. Actually, I did do it this way at one point, sort of. And I decided not to because of the enormous confusions that were introduced. One of the confusion, crucially, is that grammar, this is a technical meaning of grammar. Grammar for something in your head, grammar for state of the brain. But there's also an ordinary meaning for grammar. A grammar is a theory of language, okay? So you go to the library and you pick up something called Grammar of Sanskrit, and that's a usually bad theory of Sanskrit, okay? It's a thing that somebody wrote and stuck in the library. It's like a theory of chemistry, okay? And to confuse a theory of chemistry with chemical elements would be to get into all sorts of errors. And because of this term, and the same thing holds with universal grammar. I mean, if universal grammar is the initial state of the brain, which would be the plausible next step, then universal grammar is also traditionally used always as the theory of what's common to language. And you don't want to confuse a theory with the thing it's a theory about. So one reason not to use this terminology, I think, the amount of confusion there's been in the literature on this is appalling. You know, I mean, it's always been pointed out. You know, like everything I've written starts off by saying, don't be confused by the systematic ambiguity in the use of the word grammar and universal grammar. But everybody's always confused. And there's a big literature about how can you know a theory and this and that and the other thing. Okay, so I think just to undercut those confusions, it's best to change the terminology. The other thing is that I think that this is a more natural terminology. What I suggested at one point, I mean, I don't know if this is right, that we call this thing, I do think it makes sense to call this the language, so that when we say that John has a language, we mean John's brain is in a particular state. And I think that's a good account of knowledge generally. When John knows the construction business, it means his brain's in a particular state. So when John knows English, his brain's in a particular state. That'll fit into a reasonable account of knowledge generally, or, you know, being in a cognitive state generally. Also, it fits into a, for what it's worth, into a common sense and, in fact, even traditional linguistic conception of language as a way of speaking. Language is a way of speaking and understanding. Well, the way of doing it is the generative procedure in your head. It's not an infinite set of expressions. The reason why the infinite set of expressions is a tempting choice is because of the analogy to formal language. But that's a bad analogy, best thrown out. Pardon? An infinite set of collections of properties. Yeah. An expression just being a collection of properties or a collection of features or something. Maybe if one wants a name for the extension, also the extension has no particular significance. You know, it's a reflection of what's real. What's real is the I language. The infinite set of expressions is just what the I language happens to generate. It's not in the physical world. There aren't any physical infinite sets around. If we want a name for it, it seems to be a possible name would be the structure of the language. It's not a bad use. They hold between expressions, but they don't hold, between, in this case, they hold between expressions. In the case of rhyme, if you're talking about anaphoric reference, it holds in a certain fashion of an expression. But that comes out clearer. I mean, these are mostly questions of terminology, and, you know, you want to just pick your terminology so that people don't get confused. That seemed to be a natural choice.
seems to me that you reject the convention of realism, but it doesn't catch the point. Could you explain it?
Yeah. Intentional realism, which is a position advocated most forcefully by Jerry Fodor, is the theory that the entities of so-called folk psychology, crucially belief and desire, I mean, but also hope, you know, all the propositional attitudes. I mean, typically belief and desire are the main ones. The idea lying behind this is that there's what's called a folk psychology. We have a common sense way of interpreting what other people do, and we interpret what they do in terms of their beliefs and their desires. Like we see John pick up an umbrella when he walks out the room, and we explain that on the basis of the fact that he believes it's raining and he desires to stay dry. And then he works out a calculation that says, okay, if I desire to stay dry and I believe that it's raining, I better pick up an umbrella. Okay, that's our folk psychological account of people's behavior. And, you know, it seems sort of reasonable, something like that. Well, Fodor has argued, this all fits into the language of thought theory and everything else, that the true psychology, you know, the real account of people, whatever it is, will have to use these notions. Because unlike the notions of our folk physics, we also have folk physics. And our folk physics is our beliefs about the way the world, you know, things fall and rise and the heavens and so on. And that's all turned out to be wrong. But somehow our folk psychology is going to turn out to be right. Now, intentional realism is, these terms like belief and desire and hope are called intentional, which Brentano's term, which just means they have a relation to things. You believe something, it's a relation between you and the world. You know, so they're intentional terms. And intentional realism is the theory that says the world really consists of these entities. They're part of the world, unlike the common sense notion liquid or the common sense notion ground, let's say, which are not part of the world. But belief and desire are. That's intentional realism. The analog in, say, what's called the physical would be, for example, liquid realism. Since we have a notion liquid in ordinary language, if somebody came along and said, look, our concept liquid must be an entity in the world, that would be liquid realism. Or we have a notion household pet, say. And if somebody said, the notion household pet must be one of the natural kinds, one of the things out of which the world is constituted, that would be household pet realism. Or say key. We have a notion key, and we say, okay, key realism would be to say one of the real types of entities in the world is keys. Well, on the physicalistic side, it's all obvious nonsense. And the question is why it should be taken any more seriously on the mentalistic side. Why should folk psychology have a much more robust status than folk physics? That seems curious to you. Actually, there's a historical basis for such views. The historical basis is, I mean, you find it in people like Vico and stuff like that, that we have some special access to our own minds. It's in Locke even. You know, the constructions of our minds we're able to discover in a way that we can't discover the external world. It's as if, and if you believe that the mind is simply the repository of conscious thoughts, you know, the mind consists of a collection or structure based on things that you've consciously stuck in there, like a library where you put in books, then it would be true that you would have special access to your mind. Okay, and that's kind of the image. The image is the mind starts, neo-scholastic image, mind starts sort of blank. You have a perception, you stick it in there. You have another perception, you stick it in there. If they're close enough, you draw an association bond between them. That's the mind, and it's all conscious, you know. And if that's what the mind is, it's true we would have a special access to it, just like you have a special access to the books in your library. And this view, I'm not attributing this view to Fodor. I mean, doesn't believe it for a minute. But there's a traditional view like that, which does lead to the conclusion that the contents of your mind are accessible to you in a way that the outside world isn't. In a sense, that's true of Descartes also. You know, Descartes argues that you can get the theory of the mind directly. The theory of the world, you have to introduce a few extra assumptions, like God is not a deceiver, and so on and so forth, you know. And you gotta, whereas you don't need that for the mind, you just see it. Well, so there's a tradition, but obviously you can't make any sense out of it. I mean, that's a tradition that can't possibly be resurrected. There's no reason why we should have any more access to our minds than we have to our digestive systems. That's this story.
Yes.
And he's a philosopher. Oh, that was somebody else, yeah. That was Devid and Sterelny. Well, because that's just a tradition in philosophy that you refer to grandma. I don't know. I'm not sure where it started, but you either talk about Aunt so-and-so or grandma. If you want to refer to the sort of ordinary person, you know, there's a kind of a style in the tradition that he grew up in. It includes Jerry Fodor and, you know, a lot of young philosophers of roughly that age have picked up that style. I don't know why, you know. I don't think so. I think it's just a way of referring to folk psychology. And if you want to be cute about it, you say, ask grandma, you know. But there are all kind of articles like this, you know, with the talk about grandma and aunt so-and-so and that kind of business. Actually, there are some interesting things to say about this. There's, in modern physics as well, not just in modern philosophy, there's a note of kind of levity that didn't exist in the tradition. I mean, it's almost unimaginable that somebody like Einstein or Planck or anybody of that generation could have named the particle after something in Finnegan's wake. I mean, they would regard that as unserious, you know. But now it's done all the time, or make up, you know, colors of particles. I mean, there was a kind of level of seriousness in the intellectual tradition which is sort of gone. And I think this is a reflection of it. I don't know why that's true, but it's quite striking. Yeah.
I'd like to pose a kind of a question about that. I'd like to know your point of view.
Yeah.
What we're doing, is it interesting?
Well, sociolinguistics, in my opinion, has only one way to operate. And in fact, it has always operated this way, even if it denies it, and it usually does deny it. And that is to start by the assumption that individuals have their own I languages, and then to talk about relations and similarities among those I languages, and then to bring in other social factors, like deference and authority and kinship and so on and so forth, as depending on what you're studying. Okay, I mean, you can even bring in colors on maps if you want to look at the notion of national languages. Well, what's the status of those inquiries? Well, they certainly are of enormous human value. In fact, they deal with questions that are of more human significance than these are. But it is typical, you know, that questions of human interest commonly don't lend themselves to rational inquiry. We might ask why that's true, but it's pretty definitely true descriptively. You go back and you look at the questions raised by the Greeks, let's say. They raise a whole pile of different questions, you know. What is justice? You know, what's the nature of matter? And so on and so forth. For some of them, there's been spectacular progress. For others, there's been zero progress. And that correlates pretty well with human interest versus non-human interest, or mental, physical also. There are a lot of possible reasons for that. Sociolinguistics may turn out to be scientifically interesting, or it may not. I don't know. Actually, there are things in it which certainly are of some intellectual interest. But I think it's unlikely to become a deep subject. Any more than sociology is likely to become a deep subject. It's just dealing in part with things that are too much like the theory of everything. You know, what happens? It's bringing in too many things, you know. So you're not going to be able to find the operative things. And the other thing is, we seem to run into a blank wall when we try to carry out rational inquiry into the nature of humans. What's surprising about language, and what makes it particularly interesting, it's one of the few areas, in fact, maybe the only area, in which you're dealing with something that's mental, you know, and something that's at the core of human nature. And for some crazy reason, you can study it by the methods of the sciences. But there's nothing, almost nothing else like that. Maybe it's what I called a mystery. Our cognitive systems just aren't oriented in that direction. Or maybe there's some other reason. Oh, yeah. Look, I mean, there's no question. I mean, the importance of a discipline and its scientific character are totally dissociated, you know. I mean, you know, speaking personally, what I do of human importance is in some other area altogether where there's no science at all, you know. Here there happen to be questions of intellectual interest, but they have very little human significance in the sense that they impinge upon people's rights or needs and so on and so forth, which is quite generally the case. I mean, questions of intellectual interest and questions of human significance rarely interact, interrelate. In fact, they're usually disjoint. To interpret the world. Well, you mean it? Remember, Davidson's story is that when you try to interpret a person, this is a picture of a communication situation. So when you're trying to interpret a person, you construct a passing theory. And are you asking whether we can do the same thing when we deal with other questions?
Yeah
probably. We're probably doing it all the time. I mean, everything, you know, any as we sort of make our way around the world, we're always trying to make some sense out of what's going on, you know, give some coherence to it. I mean, whether it's building a mental map of the city you're in, or, you know, figuring out how people are placed in societies relative to one another, or whatever it may be. And we're doing the best of a bad job all the time. It's doubtful that there's going to be, so if you like, we're making passing theories and we'll modify them and so on and so forth. We'll use any means that we can. If there's any more to it than that, well, it's yet to be discovered. No, because linguistics is one of those rare areas for some, and in fact, in the study of the mind, it's about the only area that I know of, where you can proceed to identify a subpart of this messy domain of phenomena and look at that subpart and construct a really explanatory theory, which in fact bears upon other aspects of the thing. Very hard to do that elsewhere. I don't know any other place where you can do it in this domain. And therefore, you're not stuck with just, you know, messy passing theories. You can just construct actual, successful, naturalistic theories. Language has a lot of funny properties, very funny properties. I mean, the very fact that it's a digital system is a funny property. You know, language is like the natural numbers.